You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into something absolutely critical in the OR, the heart's electrical system, and specifically when it goes haywire. We're talking about perioperative arrhythmias, that moment when the rhythm on the monitor shifts and suddenly everything else seems to pause. As anesthesiologists, we're often the ones glued to that ECG, watching beat by beat. So our mission today, using our stack of advanced anesthesia sources, is to really get under the hood of these arrhythmias. We want to help you move beyond just seeing, you know, a weird line on the screen. The goal is to see it as what it truly is, a dynamic signal, maybe even a warning flare, indicating some kind of major stress on the heart or the whole system. It's about leveling up that vigilance from just recognizing patterns to really understanding the deep physiology.
Absolutely. And that shift in understanding is crucial because, honestly, the scale of this is massive, way bigger than I think many people appreciate day to day. Our sources consistently point out that arrhythmias are, hands down, the most common cardiovascular issue we deal with perioperatively. Get this, the incidence for patients having general anesthesia can hit up to 70%.
70?
Yeah, 70%. Okay, it's not a rare event then. That's practically an expectation.
Exactly. It means you're going to encounter some form of rhythm disturbance, even if it's just brief, multiple times, probably every single week you're in the OR.
So with that kind of frequency, what are the stakes? What are the actual clinical consequences we're worried about? Well, it's a huge spectrum, right? On one end, maybe it's just a bit of sinus bradycardia that resolves when you lighten the anesthetic a touch. Pretty benign. But on the other end, you're looking at potentially catastrophic events. Things like V-fib, leading straight to cardiac arrest, or maybe a stroke triggered by new onset AFib, or significant myocardial ischemia. The arrhythmia itself might be the first sign of something really bad brewing systemically.
Okay, let's unpack this. What's fascinating here and what you're highlighting is how the heart acts like a mirror, reflecting these broader problems. It's not usually just the heart deciding to act up in isolation.
Precisely. It's often screaming about something else, maybe the patient's hypoxic or becoming acidotic, perhaps the anesthetic depth isn't quite right, or there's a sudden surgical stimulus causing a big vagal response.
So when that rhythm goes off, your first thought shouldn't just be heart problem, but what's causing the heart problem? Look wider.
Exactly. And remember, these things are dynamic. They can pop up anytime. During induction, when the autonomic nervous system is all over the place. During maintenance, maybe triggered by surgical manipulation or electrolyte shifts, or even during emergence, when pain and hypertension can cause a big sympathetic surge, it's almost always an interplay.
Right, an interplay between the patient's underlying condition, the drugs we're administering, and what's actually happening in the surgical field. It's complex. So let's start mapping this out. Part one, the epidemiology and scope of vulnerability. Where should we focus our attention first based on sheer frequency? What are the most common rhythms we'll see?
Okay, number one, far and away, are the supraventricular arrhythmias. We're talking atrial fibrillation, AFib, and supraventricular tachycardia, or SVT. These probably account for something like 40% of all the rhythm disturbances we see perioperatively, often triggered by things like atrial stretch from fluid shifts or just high sympathetic tone.
40% SVTs. And while maybe not immediately life-threatening like VT, you mentioned AFib earlier having serious consequences. Can you expand on that? Why should AFib in recovery worry us so much?
Oh, perioperative AFib is a really good deal. It's not just a rhythm nuisance. The data shows it pretty much doubles the patient's risk of having a stroke after surgery.
Doubles the stroke risk. Wow.
Yeah. And on top of that, it messes up recovery significantly.
Yeah.
It's linked to increasing the length of stay in the ICU by like 30 to 40%.
Okay, so it's a major driver of bad outcomes and costs, even if the patient looks stable initially.
Absolutely. Definitely not something to just brush off.
And then moving down into the ventricles, the stakes get even higher there.
For sure. Ventricular tachycardia, or VT, happens less often, maybe in about 10 to 15% of cases, according to our sources. Oh. But when you see VT, alarm bells should be ringing loud. It usually means there's severe underlying stress on the myocardium. Very often, it's linked directly to acute ischemia or a really significant electrolyte problem like potassium being way off.
So VT equals think ischemia, think electrolytes immediately.
Instantly. Your focus has to shift to stabilizing the patient and figuring out if there's an ischemic cause right now.
Got it. And what about the surgical context? Are there specific types of procedures where the heart's electrical system is just inherently more vulnerable? Where are the high-risk zones?
Yeah, definitely. The risk really climbs in surgeries involving big autonomic swings, major fluid shifts, temperature changes, or obviously direct manipulation of the heart. So cardiac surgery is the obvious one. But also thoracic surgery, big neurosurgical cases, especially if there's potential for brainstem involvement causing autonomic chaos. And critically, laparoscopic procedures. That co-uroinsufflation can cause some dramatic vagal responses we need to be ready for. The environment itself in these cases is just primed for arrhythmias.
Okay, that sets the stage. Now let's zoom in on the patient themselves, particularly the one who comes to the OR already carrying some cardiac baggage, someone with a pre-existing condition that sets them up for electrical trouble.
Right, the substrate matters hugely. Let's break down a few key ones. First, think about the patient with coronary artery disease, CAD. If you have parts of the heart muscle that are ischemic or scarred from a previous event, they just don't conduct electricity normally. They conduct it slowly, unevenly. These boundaries between healthy and damaged tissue, they create the perfect conditions for reentry circuits. The electrical impulse hits a dead end or a slow zone, has to go around, and ends up re-exciting tissue that should be resting. That's how you get VT or VF.
So the scar tissue essentially creates these little electrical racetracks, these loops that trap the current. What about heart failure?
With heart failure, especially if the ejection fraction is low, say below 40%, the heart chambers are often remodeled, they're stretched, there's fibrosis. This physical stretch can actually activate certain ion channels in the heart cells, making them more prone to firing spontaneously or facilitating those reentry pathways we just talked about. The volume overload and wall stress directly prime the atria for AFib and the ventricles for VT. The mechanics drive the electricity here.
And valvular disease, how does that fit in?
Think about something like chronic mitral stenosis. The left atrium is constantly dealing with high pressure. It gets dilated, stretched out over time. That physical enlargement, that structural change in the atrium, creates an ideal environment for atrial fibrillation to develop and sustain itself. The altered architecture is key.
Makes sense. Structure dictates function or dysfunction in this case. But it's not just about the fixed structure, is it? You mentioned the crucial reversibles earlier, the metabolic stuff, the electrolytes. These seem like things we can and must manage acutely.
Oh, absolutely critical, and often the immediate trigger. Let's nail down the big three. First, potassium CO. This ion basically sets the electrical baseline, the resting membrane potential. So if you have hypokalemia potassium less than, say, 3.5 millimole drive a well, the resting potential gets more negative. Sounds counterintuitive, but this actually slows down the repolarization phase, phase three. This leads directly to a prolonged QT interval on the ECG. And that prolonged QT, that's the setup for a particularly nasty arrhythmia called torsades de pointe.
Right, that twisting pattern. And the flip side, too much potassium.
Hyperkalemia CO above 5.5 or so is progressively dangerous. It makes the resting potential less negative, closer to the firing threshold. Initially, you see those classic peaked T waves. But as it gets worse, it dramatically slows down the initial depolarization, phase zero. That's why the QRS complex starts to widen out, keep going, and you get this bizarre sine wave pattern, and eventually the heart just stops. A systole. We can see this acutely after massive transfusion or with kidney failure patients. It happens fast.
Scary how quickly that can evolve. And the third crucial one, magnesium, often feels like the forgotten electrolyte.
It really shouldn't be. Magnesium MgO is vital. Hypomagnesemia, let's say below 1.7 mgDL, messes with a fundamental pump, the NOD-CoATase, which destabilizes the whole cell membrane. Magnesium also directly influences potassium channels. So low magnesium itself can lead to polymorphic VT, which is why it's the go-to treatment for torsades, even if the potassium level seems okay.
Okay, so K and Mg need to be right at the top of our checklist for reversible causes.
Absolutely. Check them, fix them. They're often the lowest hanging fruit when an arrhythmia pops up.
So we've got the vulnerable patient, maybe with underlying disease, maybe with an electrolyte issue, and now we step in with our powerful anesthetic drugs. This brings us neatly to part two, anesthetic pharmacology as a trigger. Our own tools can sometimes bite back, right?
They sure can. Almost every anesthetic agent we use has some electrophysiological effect. They're definitely double-edged swords in this context. Take the volatile agents, isoflurane, sevoflurane, desflurane. They're known culprits for prolonging the QTC interval. How? Well, they specifically interfere with certain potassium channels, particularly the IKR channels. These are crucial for that rapid repolarization phase three. By slowing that down, they stretch out the QT.
Okay, so it's a direct hit on the reset mechanism. How much prolongation are we talking? That is a small increase a big deal?
Clinically, we start getting really concerned when the QTc pushes past 500 milliseconds. That's generally considered the danger zone. So if a patient comes in with a baseline QTc that's already borderline, maybe 460 meters, and then we add sevelclerine, which might add another 40 or 50 meters, boom, you're potentially over 500 meters. Combine that with maybe a little dip in potassium or magnesium, and you really set the stage for torsades. We have to factor that drug effect into our overall risk assessment.
Got it. What about the IV agents we rely on so heavily? Propofol, ketamine.
Propofol, our go-to induction agent, often causes sinus bradycardia. Why? It tends to increase parasympathetic tone, hitting the brakes via the vagus nerve. Sometimes we even need a bit of glycopyrrolate to counteract it.
So even our friendliest drug is actively slowing the heart rate.
Exactly. And then you have ketamine. It does the opposite. It's sympathomimetic, causing a release of catecholamines. Great for blood pressure sometimes, but it ramps up myocardial oxygen demand. Now, imagine giving that to someone with underlying, maybe undiagnosed coronary artery disease. That sudden increase in demand could easily tip them into ischemia, which then triggers VT.
A hidden risk there. And muscle relaxants. I know succinylcholine carries a specific warning.
Yes, succinylcholine requires extreme caution in certain situations. Think major burns, crush injuries, certain neuromuscular diseases where the acetylcholine receptors are upregulated or abnormal. In these patients, sux can cause a massive, uncontrolled release of potassium from the muscle cells into the bloodstream. This leads to acute, severe hyperkalemia, potentially causing bradycardia, wide QRS, and even a systole within minutes. It's a known dangerous interaction.
Definitely one to keep front of mind. So beyond the drugs we inject, the actual surgical environment plays a huge role too. You mentioned the surgical triggers.
Big time. These often involve sudden, massive shifts in autonomic balance. The classic one we see all the time is during laparoscopy with pneumoperitoneum and coiro insufflation. That rapid stretching of the peritoneum is a powerful vagal stimulant. It can cause profound sinus bradycardia, even sinus arrest, often with accompanying hypotension. It's a direct reflex.
A reflex we need to anticipate. And simple things like body temperature.
Hugely important. Hypothermia slows everything down, including the heart's electrical cycle. It prolongs repolarization, essentially mimicking the effect of QT prolonging drugs, creates that vulnerability. Conversely, hyperthermia increases the body's metabolic rate and myocardial oxygen demand. In a susceptible heart, that increased demand can be the trigger for ischemia and arrhythmias. So keeping the patient normothermic is a fundamental protective measure.
Okay, this is all making sense. The patient factors, the drug factors, the surgical factors. But here's where it gets really interesting. Let's go deeper. If propofol causes bradycardia via the vagus nerve, what's happening inside the heart cell? What makes the pacemaker slow down, or what causes that reentry loop to start? We need to talk about the electricity at the cellular level. Part three, molecular electrophysiology.
Right, let's get down to the nitty-gritty, the action potential, AP. Think of the AP as the electrical command cycle for each heart cell. Fire, contract, reset, rest.
Give us the simplified tour of the phases again.
Okay, super quick. Phase zero, that's the explosive start. Sodium channels fly open, sodium ions not forward, rush in, massive electrical surge. That's your QRS complex on the ECG. Then phase two, the plateau phase. Calcium channels open, calcium trickles in. This holds the cell in a depolarized state and triggers the actual muscle contraction. Then phase three, time to reset. Potassium channels open wide, potassium flows out of the cell. This brings the voltage back down, repolarizing the cell, getting it ready for the next beat. That relates to the T wave.
Depolarize, contract, repolarize, relax.
Got it. So arrhythmias are basically glitches in that ionic traffic flow.
Exactly. Any disruption in how those ions, sodium, calcium, potassium, move across the cell membrane at the right time and in the right amounts can lead to an arrhythmia. Our sources usually boil it down to about five key mechanisms that cause this chaos.
Okay, let's tackle them. Mechanism one, the cell just firing too fast on its own.
That's enhanced automaticity. Think of the natural pacemaker cells, like those in the sinus node. They have this gradual upward drift in voltage during their resting phase four. If something speeds up that drift, like sympathetic stimulation from stress, pain, light anesthesia, or drugs like epinephrine, the cell hits its firing threshold much sooner. The drummer just starts beating faster. Clinically, this gives you things like sinus tachycardia or maybe ectopic beats firing off from other parts of the atrium or ventricle.
Makes sense. The pacemaker is just overactive. Mechanism two, reentry circuits. This sounds like the short circuit idea, the structural problem you mentioned earlier. It is, and it's probably the most common mechanism behind sustained rapid heart rhythms like SVT, AFib, and VT. It's a bit more complex. You need a couple of things. Two distinct electrical pathways connected at both ends, forming a potential loop. And crucially, you need a one-way block somewhere in that loop. So the electrical impulse goes down one path just fine, but gets blocked going down the other. But maybe it can conduct slowly up the blocked path and reverse. By the time that slow signal gets back to the start of the first path, that tissue is recovered and is ready to be stimulated again. So the impulse just keeps circling around, trapped in the loop, firing over and over.
Ah, so it creates its own perpetual motion machine, electrically speaking, leading to those really fast rates.
Precisely. And the substrate for this loop, the thing that creates the block or the slow zone, is usually some kind of structural issue, scar tissue from an old MI, fibrosis, maybe abnormal pathway someone was born with.
Okay, that covers loops. Now, triggered activity or after depolarizations. This sounds like the cell tries to reset, but glitches, like aftershocks.
That's a great analogy. The cell isn't resetting cleanly. There are two main types, depending on when they happen, relative to the main action potential. First, early after depolarizations, EADs. These occur during the repolarization phase, phase 2 or 3, before the cell is fully reset. They happen when repolarization is significantly prolonged, think long QT syndrome, maybe from drugs like sevoflurane blocking those IKR channels, or severe hypokalemia. The cell membrane voltage lingers too long near the threshold, and sometimes leftover inward currents like calcium or sodium can trigger another premature firing. This specific mechanism is what causes torsades to point.
Like the power flickering back on briefly before the system fully shuts down?
Kind of, yeah. The other type is delayed after depolarizations, EADs. These happen after the cell has fully repolarized, usually during the resting phase, phase 4. DADs are typically caused by calcium overload inside the cell. Think digoxin toxicity or maybe a massive surge of catecholamines. This excess intracellular calcium gets spontaneously released from storage, causing a little bump in voltage that can trigger an unwanted beat if it's big enough.
Okay, so EADs from slow reset, DADs from calcium overload. What else can go wrong at the cellular or system level?
Well, we have to consider straightforward conduction blocks. This isn't about loops or extra beats, just the signal not getting through properly. Fibrosis, ischemia, inflammation can all damage the conduction system. The AV node, the bundle branches, this leads to things like Mobitz blocks or complete heart block.
And the nervous system's influence again.
Right. Autonomic imbalance. We touched on this with surgical triggers. Sudden massive swings in vagal tone, like the oculocardiac reflex from eye pressure or peritoneal stretch or sympathetic turn, can just overwhelm the heart's normal rhythm control. It's not a cellular defect per se, but the external input driving the heart rate way too high or way too low too fast.
That covers a lot of ground, from faulty pacemakers to bad wiring to external shocks. It really connects the dots from the clinical picture back to the cellular mechanics. Which brings us back to the monitor. Part 4, clinical recognition and ECG decoding. What do we actually do when that alarm goes off?
Okay, boots on the ground. When the rhythm changes, you need a clear head and a systematic approach. Our sources emphasize three core steps almost simultaneously. First, assess hemodynamics. Before you even squint to the ECG details, is the patient okay? Check the blood pressure. Look at the end tidal heliuros. It's a rough but quick indicator of cardiac output. Check the oxygen saturation. Are they perfusing? Second, identify rate and regularity. Simple questions. Is it fast? Slow? Is the rhythm regular like a metronome, completely chaotic, or somewhere in between like regularly irregular? Third, examine the QRS width. This is a key differentiator. Is the QRS complex narrow, usually less than 120 milliseconds, suggesting the origin is above the ventricles, supraventricular? Or is it wide, greater than 120 meters, pointing towards a ventricular origin or aberrant conduction?
Stability, rate regularity, QRS width. Okay, let's apply that. Starting with the slow rhythms, the bradyarrhythmias.
The most common is sinus bradycardia. Heart rate less than 60, but crucially, every QRS complex is preceded by a normal-looking P wave, and the PR interval is constant. Management here is all about symptoms. If the blood pressure is fine, the patient is stable, maybe you just watch or adjust your anesthetic depth or reduce opioids. If they're hypotensive or showing poor perfusion, then you treat, usually starting with atropine.
But then we get into the heart blocks, which sound more ominous. Particularly differentiating Mobitz from Mobitz 2 seems important.
Hugely important. Mobitz 2 is the one you really worry about. It looks like suddenly drop beats, you'll see P waves marching along, and then just no QRS follows one of them. Critically, the PR interval of the conducted beats before the drop to beat remains constant. This usually indicates a block lower down in the conduction system, below the AV node. It's unstable, can progress suddenly to complete heart block. Seeing Mobitz 2 is a major red flag. Think ischemia, prepare for pacing.
And complete heart block.
That's unmistakable. The atria P waves and the ventricles QRS complexes are totally out of sync. They're both beating, but at their own independent rates, completely dissociated. You need to intervene immediately, usually with temporary pacing, to maintain adequate cardiac output.
Okay, shifting gears to the fast rhythms, the tachyarrhythmias. How does the QRS width help us here?
It's the first branching point. If it's a narrow complex tachycardia, QRS under 20 millimeters, it's likely supraventricular. The classic example is atrial fibrillation, AFib. You recognize AFib by its hallmark. It's irregular. There's no pattern to the ventricular response. And if you look closely at the baseline, you won't see clear P waves, just this chaotic fibrillation line. Management. If unstable, hypotension, shock, immediate synchronized cardioversion. If stable, the goal is usually rate control first, maybe with beta blockers or calcium channel blockers, while you figure out why they flipped into AFib. Hypoxia, dot sepsis, dot volume overload.
And the wide complex ones, the really scary looking ones.
If you see a wide complex tachycardia, QRS 120 meters, your default assumption for safety has to be that it's ventricular tachycardia VT until proven otherwise. Treat it as the most dangerous possibility first. VT is typically regular or can be slightly irregular and fast. Remember the triggers. Ischemia, electrolyte chaos. Management depends entirely on whether there's a pulse. Pulseless VT, that's cardiac arrest, immediate defibrillation, and CPR. VT with a pulse, assess stability. Unstable, hypotensive chest pain, altered mental status, urgent synchronized cardioversion. Stable, you have a bit more time, usually starting with antiarrhythmic drugs like amiodarone.
And we absolutely have to mention torsades de pointe, again, that specific type of VT.
Yes, torsades de pointe is critical to recognize because the treatment is different. It's a polymorphic VT, meaning the QRS complexes vary in shape and amplitude. The classic ECG finding is that the peaks of the QRS seem to twist around the baseline, like a ribbon. And crucially, it always happens in the setting of a prolonged QT interval beforehand. Remember the triggers, low magnesium, low potassium, certain drugs, sevoflurane, ondansetron, many others. Seeing torsades means give magnesium, stop offending drugs.
That case study from the source about the laparoscopic surgery really brings the reflex bradycardia home. Can you walk us through that one?
Right. It's a perfect illustration of cause and effect. So you have a 45-year-old patient having a routine laparoscopic gallbladder removal. The surgeon starts insufflating the abdomen with co-uric gas. Almost immediately, as the peritoneum stretches, the heart rate tanks drops down to 28 beats per minute. Blood pressure plummets. The ECG shows sinus arrest or profound sinus bradycardia. What's the critical first step? Not just grabbing the atropine, but telling the surgeon, stop insufflating, let the gas out, remove the trigger. Once the stimulus, the peritoneal stretch, is removed, then you give the atropine 0.5 milligram IV in this case. And sure enough, the heart rate quickly recovers back to a normal range.
It's a fantastic example. Sometimes the cure isn't in a vial. It's in stopping what's causing the problem. Remove the vagal stimulus first.
Absolutely. That stimulus response loop is key in reflex bradycardias.
That leads us perfectly into part 5, management principles and algorithmic therapy. Okay, the arrhythmia is happening. We've recognized it. What's the overarching strategy? How do we approach treatment systematically?
Right. When things are hitting the fan, you need a clear framework. Our sources consistently point to 3 pillars for managing any acute arrhythmia. Pillar 1. Assess stability. Is the patient stable or unstable? Are they conscious? Is the blood pressure adequate? Any signs of shock, chest pain, shortness of breath? This dictates how fast you need to act and whether electricity comes first. Pillar 2, correct reversible causes. While you're assessing, think ABCs. Oxygenation okay. Ventilation adequate. Can I quickly fix an electrolyte issue? Get a stat gas if you suspect acidosis or potassium problems. Check anesthetic depth. Don't just treat the rhythm, treat the cause if possible. Pillar 3, apply algorithmic therapy. Once you've assessed stability and considered reversible causes, you follow the established protocols like the ACLS algorithms for the specific rhythm you've identified.
Okay, let's walk through some common unstable scenarios using that framework. Unstable bradycardia, patient is slow and hypotensive.
Right, unstable bradycardia. First line drug is almost always atropine. Give 0.5 milligram IV push. You can repeat that every 3-5 minutes up to a total dose of 3 milligram. If atropine doesn't work, or if you suspect the block is very low down, like Mobitz the second or third degree block where atropine is less likely to help, you need to move to other options. That means either starting an infusion of dopamine, usually 5-10 micrograms per gram, or epinephrine, 210 micrograms lecithin, titrating to effect. If drugs fail or you need time, transcutaneous pacing is the next step. Get the pads on early if you think you might need them.
Got it. What about stable SVT? Fast, narrow, complex, but the patient's blood pressure is holding up for now.
For stable SVT, you have a bit more time to work through options. First, try vagal maneuvers, things like carotid sinus massage, if no contraindications like Bruce's, or having the patient bear down like they're having a bowel movement, Valsalva. Sometimes this alone breaks the rhythm. If vagal maneuvers don't work, the go-to drug is adenosine. It's super short-acting and works by blocking the AV node. Give 6 milligrams as a rapid IV push, followed immediately by a fast saline flush. If that doesn't convert the rhythm within a minute or two, you can give a second dose of 12 milligrams. If adenosine works but the SVT keeps coming back, or if adenosine fails, then you'd consider longer-acting AV nodal blockers like IV beta blockers, Esmolol is nice because it's short-acting, or calcium channel blockers like diltiazem.
Okay. Now for VT with a pulse, wide complex, fast, but they're still generating a blood pressure.
Right, VT with a pulse. Here, stability is still the key question. If they show any signs of instability, low BP, chest pain, confusion, shortness of breath, the answer is immediate synchronized cardioversion. Don't wait. Start typically with 100-200 joules biphasic. If they have VT with a pulse but seem relatively stable for the moment, you can try antiarrhythmic medication first. The primary drug here is usually amiodarone, 150 mg IV infused over 10 minutes. You can also consider procainamide or Sotalol depending on the situation and local protocols.
And if that pulse disappears, pulseless VT or its chaotic cousin, ventricular fibrillation, VF.
That's cardiac arrest. It triggers the full ACLS pulseless arrest algorithm. Immediate priorities are high-quality CPR and early defibrillation. As soon as the defibrillator is ready, shock them usually 200 joules biphasic for VF pulseless VT. Resume CPR immediately after the shock. During CPR cycles, the main drug is epinephrine 1 mg IV every 3-5 minutes. If the first couple of shocks don't work for VF pulseless VT, then you add an antiarrhythmic, typically amiodarone 300 mg IV bolus. You can give a second dose of 150 mg if needed.
Crystal clear. And finally, back to torsades to points. You mentioned magnesium earlier. Is that the main treatment?
It is the specific first-line treatment for torsades to point. Because torsades, it's caused by those early after depolarizations linked to prolonged QT, and magnesium helps stabilize the membrane and shorten the QT interval. The standard dose is magnesium sulfate, 2 grams of NaV, given relatively slowly, over maybe 10 minutes. You give this even if you don't know the patient's magnesium level, or even if it comes back normal, because it works at the cellular level here. And just as important as giving magnesium is stopping any potential offending drugs that prolong the QT interval. Check the med list carefully. If torsades keeps recurring despite magnesium, you might need overdrive pacing to electrically suppress it.
That's a great rundown of the acute management. It's intense, requires quick thinking and knowing those algorithms cold, but ideally, we don't want to get to that point, right? This brings us to part 6, prevention and the future of cardiac vigilance. How can we be proactive and stop these arrhythmias before they even start?
Exactly. Prevention is always better than cure, especially here. It really starts before the patient even gets to the operating room. Preoperative optimization is key. We need to be aggressive about checking and correcting electrolytes beforehand. Aim for a potassium Co level ideally above 4.0 millimol and a magnesium MuCO level above 2.0 mil BODUL. Don't be afraid to supplement proactively, especially in high-risk patients or those on diuretics.
And you mentioned a critical point about chronic medications earlier.
Yes, absolutely crucial. Never abruptly stop a patient's chronic beta blockers or other antiarrhythmic medications perioperatively, unless there's a very compelling reason. Stopping them suddenly can lead to rebound tachycardia, hypertension, and significantly increased arrhythmia risk. Continue them through the perioperative period. Also, do a thorough medication review. Look for drugs the patient is already taking that are known to prolong the QT interval, certain antibiotics, antiemetics, antipsychotics. Be aware of potential interactions with our anesthetic agents.
Okay, so optimize electrolytes, continue essential meds. What about during the surgery itself? What intraoperative measures can help keep the heart's rhythm stable?
A lot of it comes down to maintaining balance. Ensure adequate depth of anesthesia. Pain and awareness trigger sympathetic surges, which are proarrhythmic. Keep the patient deep enough to block surgical stress responses. Anticipate high-risk moments. If you know a surgeon is about to do something that causes a strong vagal reflex, like carotid sinus manipulation, consider giving an anticholinergic like glycopyrrolate preemptively. And maintain homeostasis religiously. Keep them warm, normothermia, well-oxygenated normoxia, and maintain normal coUrO levels, normocapnia, Every physiological parameter that drifts away from normal increases electrical instability. Avoid rapid CO2 insufflation if possible. Allow gradual accommodation.
Are there specific drugs we can use prophylactically in high-risk patients?
Yes, there's good evidence for a couple of strategies. Beta blockers, continued perioperatively or even started beforehand in specific high-risk non-cardiac surgery patients, have been shown to significantly reduce the incidence of postoperative AFib, maybe by as much as 50%. For very high-risk patients, particularly those undergoing cardiac surgery like CIVG, some studies support preoperative loading with imipenem for several days before surgery to reduce the risk of postoperative AFib, which is incredibly common in that population. It's about risk stratification and targeted prevention.
That makes sense. Tailor the prevention to the risk. Now let's look ahead. This field isn't static. What are some of the advanced concepts and future perspectives our sources are hinting at? Where is this heading?
It's moving towards being much more personalized and predictive, leveraging both genetics and technology. One exciting area is molecular predictors. Researchers are identifying specific genetic variations, polymorphisms, in the genes that code for cardiac ion channels, like a KCNH2 gene for IKR or SCN5A for sodium channels. These variations can make individuals inherently more susceptible to things like drug-induced QT prolongation.
Wow, so imagine doing a quick genetic screen preoperatively to know if a patient is likely to have QT issues with SIBO or if they're at higher risk for certain inherited arrhythmia syndromes.
Exactly. That's the direction things are heading. It could allow for truly individualized anesthetic planning, choosing different agents, having a lower threshold for monitoring or intervention based on someone's genetic profile, moving from reactive to genuinely proactive, genetically informed care.
And technology's role, you mentioned AI earlier, how is that changing ECG monitoring?
Artificial intelligence, AI, in ECG monitoring is becoming increasingly sophisticated. The algorithms in newer monitors aren't just looking for obvious arrhythmias like VT or AFib anymore. They're capable of analyzing beat-to-beat variability, subtle changes in the shape of the QRS or T-wave morphology, things that might indicate developing ischemia or electrolyte shifts before a major arrhythmia occurs. They can potentially pick up on the earliest electrical signs of trouble.
So the AI becomes like an early warning system, augmenting our own vigilance, giving us a heads up before things go really wrong.
That's precisely the idea. Moving from simple detection to potential prediction, giving us time to intervene preemptively based on subtle trends the AI flags up. We're also getting smarter about neurocardiac crosstalk, understanding those reflexes, oculocardiac, trigeminocardiac, the vasovagal response to insufflation, not just as problems, but as circuits we can potentially modulate. Maybe using specific agents like dexmedetomidine, known for its sympatholytic and vagomimetic properties, to stabilize autonomic tone. Or using targeted local anesthetic blocks to interrupt the afferent limb of a problematic reflex.
It sounds like the goal is shifting towards creating a more stable, resilient electrical environment for the heart throughout the entire perioperative journey.
That's the essence of it. The concept of protective anesthesia, using everything in our toolbox, from optimizing electrolytes and choosing agents wisely to leveraging technology and understanding reflexes, all aimed at minimizing cardiac electrical instability. The anesthesiologist remains the ultimate guardian, the one making the final call, but equipped with deeper knowledge and better tools to anticipate and prevent, not just react.
This has been incredibly insightful. This deep dive really underscores that the anesthesiologist is constantly translating the heart's electrical language. When that language shifts from a steady rhythm to discord, we need to understand why. We need that deep knowledge connecting call levels above 4 and MU above 2 directly to cellular stability.
We've covered a lot from that staggering 70% incidence, the specific dangers of AFib and VT, how drugs like sevoflurane directly interact with ion channels, the chaos of reentry and after depolarizations, and the critical management steps for something like torsades.
And building on that future perspective from the sources, here's something to think about. If AI evolves from just detecting arrhythmias to actually predicting them with high accuracy based on genetics, real-time vitals, subtle ECG changes, how does that change our job in the moment? Imagine an alert saying 75% probability of AFib in the next 10 minutes based on current trends. Do we preemptively give a beta blocker? Do we change our anesthetic? Does the algorithm start influencing our minute-to-minute decisions? It raises fascinating questions about the future interface between human expertise and machine intelligence in maintaining cardiac stability. Food for thought. Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.